Do you know how you would react in an emergency situation? The first time I remember being put to the test with something like this was when I was 18 years old. I was just driving by myself on a sort of rural road here in Florida one morning. And as I drove down this road, I could see something odd up in the distance. It was a car off the road, and it was upside down. Probably most of us have approached accident scenes like this. You'll see one or two cars that have obviously crashed into each other, and you see fire trucks and police cars, probably an ambulance or two to take care of the injured people. But as I approached this upside-down car, there was none of that. No emergency vehicles, no one walking around, just no activity at all. So as I pulled over and got out of my car, I kind of assumed that this must have just happened. And 18-year-old me was thinking, I'm probably going to go over to this car and find dead people inside. Or people that might still be alive, but they're badly injured. And this was before cell phones, so I couldn't just call it in. I walked over to the car and got down on my hands and knees and looked inside. And I was happy to find that there was no one in that car. Whoever was driving had apparently already left the scene. And a few minutes later, a state trooper rolled up. He told me that someone else had called it in about an hour or so earlier. So he was there to check it out and make a report. There were a lot of people who saw that car and just kept driving. And I get that. Seeing or dealing with a potentially traumatic situation is not for everyone. Honestly, I wasn't sure I wanted to deal with it either. My guest today, Jonathan, was put into an emergency situation like that once. He was the passenger in a moving car when he noticed that the driver, his cousin Paul, had passed out. They were gaining speed, and up ahead were pedestrians. Real people in unreal situations.
There is a girl hanging by her broken leg from the telephone wire.
And I called 911 and I said, I found a baby.
I turned around. I see a gun pointed at me close enough I could touch it.
She would hold our heads underwater all the time.
He levels the gun, pulls the trigger, and I go down.
Her eyes were full of tears. She didn't want to leave us.
My hair catches on fire.
I swear to God, this image is burning my head for the rest of my life.
I'm Scott Johnson, and this is What Was That Like? Hey, it's Scott, and guess what? You're about to hear an ad. And that's both good and bad. It's good because ads are what make it possible for me to keep bringing you these episodes. And it's bad because, well, maybe you don't like listening to ads, and I get that. And the good news is, you don't have to. When you sign up to support the show, you get every single episode without any ads. Plus, you get all the bonus episodes. Yeah, did you know there are actually bonus episodes? And you can try it all for free just to see what it's like. If you're on an iPhone, just go to the What Was That Like podcast and at the top, click on Try Free and you're in. On Android, just go to whatwasthatlike.com/plus and try it out completely free. Once you've had the ad-free experience, you'll see why hundreds of other listeners are already doing it. But for now, here's another ad and then on with today's episode.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
You were a junior in high school when this happened. So how old were you at that time?
I would have just turned 17.
17.
Yeah.
Man, such a young age to go through something this traumatic.
Yeah.
It's kind of crazy.
Yeah, it definitely was. Yeah.
How popular was the air duster thing at that time?
It was, I would have to say, a lot of people were doing it. I remember some kids in, like, even in class would, like, hide it in their coat and then take a hit of it in class. And so it was just kind of going around the school, something kids, stupid kids were doing, you know? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So.
Did you ever try it?
Yeah, I did try it. Yeah. And it's hard to explain. It just, we called it the wah-wahs. So when you would do it, I don't know if it takes the oxygen out of your brain or what. And then you would just hear like a wah, wah, wah. And then it would go away. I mean, it was pretty quick. I mean, there's big warning labels on it that say it could freeze your lungs. And, you know, I mean, it's not a good deal.
But at the time, did you feel like it was like, you know, relatively safe, or were you aware of the bad side effects?
No, I wasn't. I think we were just trying to be cool, or, you know, I don't know, everybody was doing it, you know, so we just, I think, you know, we just didn't think of it that way.
Your friend Paul, and he was actually your cousin, right?
Yeah, he was my cousin, and we grew up together, you know, and we were very close and I would say best friends at the time. He was a little bit of an outcast regards to, like, he didn't play sports and stuff like I did. But, you know, just growing up together and stuff, we, you know, that's just what happened. We became very good friends and hung out a lot. And
was it pretty well known around the school that Paul was into the air duster stuff?
I would think it, I don't know specifically that, you know, he just was known as, like I said, an outcast, you know. He found out somehow that we could do this, and so he showed me and some friends, and, you know, we were all trying it at the time and just kind of being stupid, I guess, having fun. Yeah, being dumb kids, I guess.
The day this happened, what day of the week was it? Do you remember?
I don't remember what weekday. It was in the middle of the week, I remember.
And pretty much normal day, right?
Yeah, normal day, you know, get out to go to lunch. Our high school had an open campus, so they had the option to either stay in the cafeteria or leave for lunch. Obviously, you know, I'd say 90% of the school would leave for lunch. We had an hour for lunch because I remember we went to his house on the day of the accident, and it was a pretty good trek out there. So we knew we had time to go out to his house and have lunch and then get back to school.
All right. So you're coming back and Paul is driving. What kind of car?
He was driving a green Honda Civic. And it was his mother's car. And I don't remember the year exactly, but I know I remember the green Honda Civic. We're coming back and you take a right-hand turn into the parking lot. For some reason, as we were entering the parking lot, he decided that he wanted to take a hit off of the air duster. So he did it. I don't know, you know, if he thought somebody would see him, thought it'd be cool or whatever. So we continue to drive through the parking lot. I look over and all of a sudden he's like, his head slumped. His head wasn't in his lap, but he was slumped over like he had passed out. And I thought he was messing with me. And so I hit his shoulder a little bit, you know, like, hey man, quit messing around. You know, there's kids walking and stuff. Then I kind of realized what was, he wasn't responding to me. So then I didn't start to panic. I was just like, oh shit. Like, wake up, you know, hit the brake or whatever. I thought maybe he'd come to so we could hit the brake, stop. I could drive to park or whatever, but that was not the case.
And you mentioned earlier that this effect is gone pretty quickly. It didn't seem like it went away very quickly this time.
No, it did not. And I guess, I don't know if, like I said earlier, you know, it depletes the oxygen in your brain. All of a sudden, he was just passed out, and here we are. We're in the parking lot at lunchtime, you know.
And how fast were you going at that time?
The speed limit coming into the parking lot, you know, like 20 miles an hour. But as he passed out, his foot would hit the accelerator. So I noticed our speed started to, you know, pick up pretty significantly. And as I was trying to wake him up, I bet we were doing about 30 miles per hour and continuing to accelerate.
This is like the worst case scenario.
Oh yeah, it was. I can't hit the brake, you know, he's a bigger guy, so I don't know what I'm thinking at the time. I'm just trying to wake him up, you know, wake up, please wake up and stop, because, you know, it's not going to end well if he doesn't wake up.
What about, did you consider maybe grabbing the gear shift, put it in neutral?
After the fact, I did, you know, when you think hindsight's 20/20.
Right. Or the emergency brake right there in the center, right?
Yeah. And I never did. I was so focused on just, hey, wake up, please. You know, and it's like, he was a jokester. So it was like kind of thinking like, well, is this a joke? Or, but no, it was not a joke.
So as you're kind of panicking, and what do you see ahead of you?
I understand that he's not going to wake up. So on, you know, what's going to happen next? I look up. Now we're going faster. We're accelerating. And there's a couple, well, there's a lot of kids walking, because there's a crosswalk to go into the high school. So I look up and here's a bunch of kids. And then I see a couple and they're holding hands. Everything just slows down. Like, I don't know. Have you've seen Saving Private Ryan? This is a weird reference. Okay. So when he's on Omaha Beach, Tom Hanks' character,
the opening scene, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And there's all that like explosions and stuff, you know, and that's how it felt. That's how the best way to describe it is that something's about to happen very bad.
Was that couple, did they have their backs to you or were they coming toward you?
They're just walking across the crosswalk. So they didn't have their backs to us. So they would have been side by side. So when they would have looked to their right, they would have seen the car coming at them.
But they didn't even have a chance to get out of the way.
No. No, we were going, it was happening so fast and we were going so quickly. Like at that time when we hit them, I'm sure we're probably close to doing 50 miles per hour through the parking lot. I'm sure there's people getting out of the way and stuff. I'm just focused. I just see the people in front of me and trying to figure out how to wake him up so we can stop, you know, what's about to happen.
It seems like it's happening so fast that even if he were to wake up, he would still be disoriented, like, wow, what's happening? What do I need to do? And, you know, by that time, the car's traveled another 200 feet, probably.
Yeah. It was set in motion. You know, what was going to happen is going to happen. And we were going to hit these two kids that were right in front of us. We make impact with the couple holding hands. Her head hit the windshield. And we took her out. It would have took her out at her hips. And I'll never forget her head when it hit the windshield. It didn't break the windshield. So there was just a perfect, like if you would have thrown a baseball or a basketball at the windshield and it impacted, you know, perfect mark of her head. And it was right in front of me. So that's why I remember it so, so vividly. It just made this big crunch sound, bam. And then I knew right then, like, oh no, like we just hit a kid. I didn't at the time. Did the guy get out of her significant other get out of the way? Or I knew we had hit one person for sure. And I remember the sound of her head hitting the windshield, impacting it, and then tumbling back over the car, just like boom, boom, boom. And we hit this couple. Okay. So what happens next? Well, he's still not waking up. He doesn't know what's really going on yet. I don't remember if he was coming to yet or not, but all I know is that we're still accelerating and we're still going through the parking lot.
And are there more kids in front of you?
Yeah, there's we proceeded through the parking lot and there's kids. I can't see anything after the windshield has been impacted and it didn't explode, but it's broken. So I can't really see, you know, what's going on in front of me now. We're accelerating and there's more kids. There's kids running around, I'm sure. And then there's poles. I don't know how to describe it, but, you know, poles, like parking poles down the side to the right of us. And then to the left of us, you can take lefts down lanes into the high school parking lot. And that's where cars are. There's people standing in the parking lot just watching this all happen, you know, watching us fly through the parking lot. Yeah, it had to have been surreal for them.
I'm sure a lot of people saw the actual hit when the car hit the couple. Were those students that you knew?
I did not know them. I met them after the fact, but I didn't know them before. I mean, we had a pretty big high school. I don't remember if they were younger or older than me. Unfortunately for them, they were in the wrong place at the, you know, the wrong time. We're still accelerating through the parking lot. And at this point, I'm like, I gotta figure out how to stop this. Like we discussed, I didn't think about maybe grabbing the emergency brake or throwing it in park. So I grabbed the wheel. I knew if we went hard left that we were going to hit other cars, probably other kids. And that just didn't seem like the right choice for me. So right in front of us, there was the gym wall. So I grabbed the wheel and I remember I took it at an angle. So I pulled the car to the left. And at this point, we're doing about probably 65 miles per hour. We're moving. We're hauling ass. And
was the gym made of brick?
Yeah, it was a solid brick wall. Solid brick wall. I grabbed the wheel. I just slightly turned it to the left because I didn't want to go head on because I felt like if we went completely head on, you know, we're going to both go through the windshield. So I thought the best option was to put it at an angle. And that angle would have been to my side, the passenger side. So I turned it slightly to the left. You know, I'm not a big religious person, but I probably said a prayer at that moment and just, here we go. We're going to hit this wall going 60, solid brick wall, 65 miles an hour. I remember I turn, we hit, and I mean, my body, I don't know how I didn't go out the windshield, to be completely honest with you, and die right there. But we hit it, and I was very loose, I guess, in my right hand, hit the passenger window. And I just remember going forward like a just, whew, you know, very big impact. I compare it to like the old crash dummy like commercials, you know, when they were showing you how, you know, you're safe in the car if you have a very crazy impact or something like that. Or
if you're wearing a seatbelt. Yeah.
Yeah. I was not wearing my seatbelt. I had unbuckled to reach over and, you know, grab the wheel.
Was Paul wearing one?
I believe he was. Yes. Yeah. So we impact the wall. And I mean, all at that point, then glass and everything. I mean, just a big explosion. Boom. I mean, windshield breaks out. My hand actually broke out the passenger window, you know, the front window and on the front door because it flew over. It broke that out. Everything. It just big impact. Boom. I mean, I'm sure from the outside looking in, it just looked like a big explosion. Like the car had just blown up.
Yeah. And since you had already attracted so much attention by striking the pedestrians, by that time, probably everybody was looking at the car to see,
oh, yeah,
how's this going to end?
Yeah. They watched us hit the wall. And I just remember feeling just in shock instantly, you know, like, what the hell just happened to me, you know, and thinking it just kind of, I don't know when you're in that big of a shock. I don't know. You're just not really, I wasn't really thinking. I get, my first instinct was like, I got to get out of the car.
Did the airbags deploy?
Yeah, they deployed. I think that saved Paul from going through the windshield for sure. And it saved me as well, even though I was up, you know, I wasn't standing completely up, but I was up, you know, like maybe, you know, kind of like on my knees, you know? And so I remember that exploding out of the console and then hitting it and just it lunged me back into my seat.
How would you describe being hit by an airbag as it deploys? It can be a pretty violent thing.
Yeah. Dust everywhere, airbag dust everywhere. It threw me back in my seat. I guess maybe it'd be like getting punched by a professional boxer or something, you know, like as a normal person. They come out so fast and I mean, it did its job. It threw me back into my seat. So that was good, you know. But then and then finally, you know, I remember thinking, oh, okay, finally we're stopped.
I don't know how many other people do this, but I like to plan my weekly meals. Maybe I'm just weird, but I like quick and easy. That's just one of the benefits you can get with Cook Unity. Go to cookunity.com/what or enter code what before checkout to get 50% off your first week. One of the dishes I recently had was the Green Goddess Falafel Bowl. Oh, I loved it. The falafel was seasoned perfectly, and I love how crispy it is on the outside, but really moist on the inside. It's a signature dish of Enat Admoni. She's known around the world as a chef. You've probably seen her on TV. and her dishes are made right here in Florida, so I'm supporting local business, and I love that. And the convenience of Cook Unity is crazy. I mean, I've got podcast episodes to produce. I don't have time for cooking. These meals are delivered fully cooked. So when it's time to eat, I pick a meal based on my mood for that day, I heat it for a few minutes, and enjoy. The menus are updated every week, so there's always something new to try. You can choose from over 350 meals based on your dietary needs or taste preferences, or go wild and have Cook Unity pick for you, because every meal is just amazing.
Make the best meal plan ever with the convenience, chef-level quality, and endless variety of Cook Unity. Go to cookunity.com/what or enter code WHAT before checkout for 50% off your first week. That's 50% off your first week by using code WHAT or going to cookunity.com/what.
Something I've been recently making a deliberate effort with is to read more. There are lots of books I want to read, and I try to read every day, even if it's just a few pages. That little bit each day adds up, and it can make a big difference. It's like taking care of your gut. Even though it's not big, it supports the health of your whole body. Seed's DS01 Daily Symbiotic benefits not just your gut and your heart, which aren't outwardly visible, but your skin too, which you can see. Every morning it's the same thing, two capsules of Seed DS01. And sometimes I wonder, is it normal to feel this great? It helps support digestive health with optimal gut bacteria levels, and thankfully that's all backed up by science, and all the supporting data is on their website. If you're trying to avoid sugar, soy, peanuts, or gluten, you're good to go. And I was reading the literature and I thought, you had me at vegan, because it's that too. And if you have kids, DS01 is the first multi-strain symbiotic shown to be tolerable and health-promoting in a cohort of children aged 3 to 17. And you can use this promo code to give it a try.
Trust your gut with Seed's DS01 Daily Symbiotic. Go to seed.com/what and use code 25WHAT to get 25% off your first month. That's 25% off your first month of Seed's DS01 Daily Symbiotic at seed.com/what, code 25WHAT.
Hear that? Believe it or not, summer is just around the corner. Luckily, Armor All, America's most trusted auto appearance brand, has what your car needs to get that perfect summer shine. Plus, now through May 31st, we'll give you $5 for every $20 you spend on Armor All products. That means car wash pods, protectant, tire shine, you name it. Find out how to get your $5 rebate at armorall.com. Armor All, less work, more clean. Terms apply.
I don't remember any pain or anything right away. I just was, you know, I just remember being completely in shock and being like, I got to get out of this car like now. And at that point, I'm worried about myself. I don't know the extent of Paul's injuries or anything. I'm just like, I got to get out of here now. Get me out of this car.
And you also don't know if the other people were dead.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, I just knew. I needed to get out of the car and figure out what was going on and get help. You know, I need help.
And the door was able to open?
The wheel, the passenger front wheel had pushed up into my door. So I remember I had the door open slightly, but I remember prying it, so kicking it with my foot to get myself out of there. I had to put my foot up and I pushed it and I got it to where, you know, I'm a skinnier kid, so I got out.
And was Paul still out?
At that point, yeah, he stayed in the car for a little bit. I don't know if he had, I'd imagine that impact woke him up. But like I said, at that point, I'm focused on myself. So I get myself out of the vehicle. And then at that point, I'm a pretty popular guy. So, and everybody knows the car, you know, I mean, you know, you know what your friends drive and stuff when you're in high school, you know, so everybody knows like, oh shit, that was Jonathan and Paul, you know? So then I can get myself out of the car. And I remember then I had friends running straight to the car to help us. They didn't know what had happened. You know, at that point, no one knows there's a can of air duster involved. Nobody knows, you know, that there was something shady going on with the driver. They just are thinking, what happened? You know, who knows what happened, right? You know, they don't know. They just want to help us and get us safe, you know?
Right. Yeah. That's the first instinct is who's hurt? Who can we help?
Yeah.
You know, immediately.
Right. So I'm out of the car. And then, like I said, I remember a lot of people running up to us. So at this point, I know what had happened inside the car. So I had a friend who came up to me and he's like, what the hell is going on? You know? And I'm like, man, he was doing air duster. And I remember the look on his face and he's like, are you kidding me? And I'm like, no. And he passed out. So we need to get that out of the vehicle. And he's like, okay. So my buddy physically gets into the car and he finds the air duster can. I remember watching him run over to the dumpster and he got it out of there and he threw it away for us. So that initially, you know, I'm not thinking at the time, you know, cops start asking questions, stuff like that. I'm just trying to save his butt a little bit, you know, and I'm thinking guilty by association too. So what's going to happen to me? You know, I don't want anybody to know. I don't know how we're going to swing this when we get into the hospital and have to start talking to police and stuff like that. But for the moment being, let's try to hide, you know, the cause of what happened at first, which is horrible. But I think that's just, you know, it's just what I was thinking at the time.
Yeah. I'm picturing people hearing this story and hearing that your thought was get rid of the evidence.
Yeah.
And, yeah. I mean, you realize yourself at this point that was bad.
Yeah. That was the wrong move. I was just trying to protect my friend and my family. I mean, he was my family. He's my family member. So I was just trying to protect him.
Obviously, somebody called the ambulance, called police.
Yes.
How soon before that they showed up?
We live in a small town, not super small, but, you know, we're some people. And the first police officer, actually, that was on the scene, I knew from, he was my father's friend. So I remember seeing his face and thinking, I was just a little bit, I felt more at ease. You know, okay, I know somebody, I know the police officer, he knows me. So he calmed me down, got me sat down. And then I'm like, well, I would remember you got to call my mom. So we got to call my parents and let them know right away. She needs to know. And I need, you know, my parents with me. I don't remember if I gave him my cell phone or he might have, I don't know. I gave him my mom's number, but he called my mom. Then all of a sudden she's just there like an angel or so. She popped up out of nowhere. And there's my mom, you know, she's there to help. So
that's what moms do.
Yeah. Yes, it is. You know, after talking with the police officer, then I started really realizing that what had just happened and you know, what's going on, how bad it is. More cops are coming, 2, 3, 4 ambulances are coming because we all go in our own ambulances. So here come 4 ambulances, you know, sirens everywhere. And then I remember seeing administrators and teachers from the school out there, you know, and just knowing like, yeah, this, what just happens, very bad deal.
Yeah. I would imagine there would be another scene over where the couple were.
Yeah. I remember looking up. I remember looking up and once the paramedics and stuff got there and they were working on them. They weren't, you know, getting them into the neck braces and stuff. They were mad at me because I had gotten out of the car and during like a major car accident, they don't want you to move your neck and your head and stuff in case you do have a bad, like a back or neck injury. So as soon as the paramedics are on scene, they all have us laying down and on stretchers and gurneys so they can, you know, make sure to get us secure and make sure that we don't have any major injuries.
So what were your injuries? Just your hand?
Yeah, I had a bunch of cuts and stuff on my hands, arms, and my face from just the glass, you know, cuts. And then I had broken my right hand.
And how about Paul? How bad was he?
Paul had no injuries at all. At this point, he has gotten himself out of the vehicle. You know, there's people around and it's my mom's, it's her nephew, you know, so she's up there. She put some blankets and stuff on him. He made his way towards the door of the school. I found this out later, but I don't know why. And he was just sitting there watching everything happen, waiting for the ambulance or to take him as well.
Yeah, but I mean, I'm thinking, as shocked as you were when you guys went through and hit the wall and like, man, what just happened? He had to be completely confused when he woke up.
Yeah, he had no clue. He woke up to complete chaos. You know, I don't know exactly his words to paramedics and people talking to him, because at this point, I'm by myself with paramedics and, you know, they're getting me ready to go. And I remember my mom asking me what happened, and I'm just like, he passed out. She's like looking at me like, what do you mean he passed out? You know, that's just what happened. And then she is sitting there confused too. Like, well, what did he have, a medical condition or something that we didn't know about? Or I remember just a lot of confusion going on. You know, why'd this happen? These are two young, healthy, you know, teenagers, but there's just confusion on why is this, what happened? Why is this, what happened? Just happened in the parking lot at lunch, you know?
I mean, you knew at that time the primary concern is get everyone taken care of, get to the hospital, you know, make sure the injuries are taken care of. But you had to be thinking back of your mind, okay, there's going to be more questions.
And oh, yeah.
Were you wondering, how am I going to handle that?
Yeah, I was. And I'm 17, so I know that, you know, my parents are going to have to be with me if I'm talking to like a police officer or something like that. But I knew on the ride to the hospital, you know, just everything starts to set in and that my stomach starts to turn. And I know what's about to happen is it's not going to be good, especially for him. I know that he's screwed.
How badly injured were the two people that he ran into?
I didn't really know until we got to the hospital. The gentleman, he broke his leg, and she, luckily enough, she had a pretty bad concussion and stuff. And they were in the ICU they weren't in there for a very long, day or two, but luckily they were okay. I mean, nothing, they didn't die. Thank God they didn't die. But I think that the thing was that they didn't see it coming. So they didn't tense up or anything, you know, they were just loose. So it was just a shock of, they just getting hit by a vehicle. So luckily no one's dead. At the point when we leave the school, my mom and my dad are there, but I went in the ambulance by myself. I have a younger brother, so by this point they have to go. He's hearing things too, so they got to get him taken care of. So I go to the hospital by myself. I just remember being really cold and in this cold hospital emergency room. And I felt like, you know, I was in there by myself forever. There was a police officer. He came in really abrasive and being mean, I felt like, to me. You know, he just started grilling me right away. You know, what happened? What were you guys doing? What drugs? Were the drugs? What this stuff? You know, all these questions. And I'm like, at this point, I'm not saying anything. I'm like, look, I remember telling him, you can wait for my mom and my dad to get here and then we can have a discussion. You know, I wasn't going to say anything to him until my parents got there. And I didn't think it was right of him as an adult now. I don't think it's right of him to come in there and ask a kid, start grilling him after, you know, I just went through a really traumatic experience, you know.
Did he know you were the passenger?
He never clarified on that. He just knew I was in the car. So he never clarified and came in, hey, I might have been more open to talk to him if he came in and was very just like, hey, I know you were in the vehicle and you're the passenger. Can you kind of tell us, you know, enlighten us on what happened in there today? Or it was more or less, he just wanted to start grilling me like I was a murder suspect or something. And I, at that point, I'm like just trying to process in my own mind, you know, what happened.
And really, with the potential criminal aspect of this, you really shouldn't have spoken at all until you've got an attorney representing you.
Yeah. And that, yeah, that's, I think that as well. And also, you know, like I'm a minor, so I need my parents to be there with me. And also, you know, I'm a victim as well. In the eye, you know, I was not driving. I was not under the influence of anything, because obviously they're taking our blood. I don't remember if they're making me do a breathalyzer or anything like that, but I remember them taking my blood, But the hospital is doing their things as well to, you know, just so everybody knows, you know, what's in my system and stuff as well.
You know, I just thought of this. I wanted to ask you, the police said that they saw the video of this. Why was there a video? Who took that?
There was the high school had surveillance cameras outside so that they could see. And I didn't realize there was a video of it until later down the road. So initially when we're in the hospital, maybe they had seen the video or not, but later on they said, yeah, we saw the video. And I got a little bit of praise for at least saving, I guess I saved some kids' lives by taking the wheel. So that's a good feeling, you know?
So you're still in the ER and you have some family come in.
My parents showed up together, and then I'm thinking, oh man, my dad, he was a military guy. So, you know, we had a very structured home life and he was very, very put together, very, this is what we got to do, you know? So I remember being really scared to talk to my dad about what had happened just because, you know, we're structured and he doesn't like when things go off script, you know, this is what we do. And so I just remember looking at him and he just, you know, he's like, tell me what happened. And at this point I'm telling him what happened and I'm just kind of playing dumb. Like, I don't know, mom, dad, I don't know what happened. You know, he just, all of a sudden he was just passed out. The thing about that, me telling them that, is that they know Paul. So they kind of know his history, right? They know that he's a, you know, maybe a little bit of an outcast, a little troublemaker, lives on the edge a little bit. So they're not buying it from me at that time, but they're not going to press me any harder. They just want to make sure that I'm safe and that I get my injuries taken care of, and they're just happy I'm not dead.
There was some point in the ER where your uncle came in.
Yeah, so my uncle, and that would have been Paul. It was Paul's stepdad, but he was with Paul a lot through his life. So, and we were very close, me and him. So he came in and he's like, hey, what happened? Because like I said, it's known that Paul isn't, you know, he lives on the edge a little bit, you know, not afraid of things. So it's known they're not buying, hey, there was no drugs or alcohol or there was something involved. And so my uncle's trying to get it out of me and I'm laying there and I'm like, I don't know, you know, I don't know what happened. He just all of a sudden I looked over and he's passed out, you know, and my uncle's looking at me and I just remember his face like, I know you're full of shit, man, but, you know, okay. You know, he's like, I'll take your word for it, Jonathan. Thinking about it, I don't know why I was trying to protect him, but he was my best friend at the time, you know, and I think as a kid and, you know, a young kid, you don't want to see any of your friends get in trouble. And I think I knew how bad it was going to be for him, you know, once they found out he was under the influence of something and, you know, it wasn't going to end up well for him.
Did the police specifically ask you about drugs or if there was one of the air cans in the car? Because obviously they didn't find it in the car. It had already been tossed.
Right. And no one ever said anything to me about it. And they asked, you know, were you guys drinking at lunch? No, obviously, you know. Were you guys smoking, you know, like marijuana or something? No, we weren't. So we're in the ER and I'm sitting in my room and then my uncle, probably about an hour later, then he comes back in and he looks at me and he goes, well, Paul just gave himself up, so you can tell the truth now. And then I just felt like this sigh of relief, like, oh, okay, I can tell everybody really what happened. I like to think of myself as an honest human being, even at 17. I mean, you lie about, when you're a kid, you know, you get scared, lie about dumb stuff. But I mean, I was just raised and taught that, you know, just tell the truth. When you tell the truth, you have a better shot of, I don't know, it just works out better for you.
Did it occur to you at all? I mean, you said you were immediately relieved. Now you can just be open about it. But as you said that, it occurred to me that it could be that your uncle was bluffing.
You just blew my mind. I've never thought of that before. Yeah, I've never have thought that before at all. I just the way he looked at me, Because he was, I could kind of tell he was mad at me as well for like just not telling him straight up. They're just like him, my dad, they're just honest guys, you know, hardworking guys. So they just want to know the truth. What happened? You know, they can't help you or help fix it if they don't know the truth right off the bat. Yeah, just by the look on his face.
You said that you later on talked to the two people that got hit. How did that happen?
So it's kind of weird. We're all three, there's three of us as victims. So we all had to meet with the, after Paul had told him what went on and everything, then obviously criminal charges were brought against him. He was being charged with a felony DUI. But anyway, we had to meet with the DA and everybody tell their side of the story, kind of give like a victim impact statement to the DA. We didn't have to go into the courtroom. Thank goodness. I didn't have to go and look him, you know, in the eyes at court. That would have been horrible. But we all met with the DA and kind of told her my side of the story. And that's how I met them.
Did you have a chance to talk with them, or you just heard what they said?
I heard what they said. I remember them being very nice to me, actually. You know, this wasn't your fault. You're lucky you're alive as well. And maybe they were just saying that to my face. You know, I don't know, you know, what they would say behind me, behind closed doors.
But that's the truth. It wasn't your fault.
No. And, but I felt, you know, I think when you're in a situation like that, I felt a tremendous amount of guilt for her a long time after the fact. What could I have done different to just stop the whole thing? Why'd he do it? There's a lot of whys and what could have I done, you know, but it played hard on the psyche for sure and my mental health as a young kid.
Hey, do you have trouble sleeping? Then maybe you should check out the Sleepy Podcast. It's a show where I read old books in the public domain to help you get to sleep. It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. It was the age of classic stories like A Tale of Two Cities, Pride and Prejudice, Winnie the Pooh. Stories that are great for adults and kids alike. For years now, Sleepy has helped millions of people catch some much-needed Z's, start their next day off fresh, and discover old books that they didn't know they loved. So, whether you have a tough time snoozing or you just like a good bedtime story, fluff up the cool side of your pillow and tune into Sleepy. Unless you're driving, then please don't listen to Sleepy. Find Sleepy on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes each week. Sweet dreams.
Welcome to the I Can't Sleep podcast with Benjamin Boster. If you're tired of sleepless nights, you'll love the I Can't Sleep podcast. I help quiet your mind by reading random articles from across the web to bore you to sleep with my soothing voice. Each episode provides enough interesting content to hold your attention, and then your mind lets you drift off. Find it wherever you get your podcasts. That's I Can't Sleep with Benjamin Boster.
Do you want to know what it's like to hang out with MS-13 in El Salvador? How the Russian mafia fought battles all over Brooklyn in the 1990s.
Or what about that time I got lost in the Burmese jungle hunting the world's biggest meth lab? Or why the Japanese Yakuza have all those crazy dragon tattoos? I'm Sean Williams.
And I'm Danny Gold. And we're the hosts of the Underworld Podcast. We're journalists that have traveled all over, reporting on dangerous people and places. And every week, we'll be bringing you a new story about organized crime from all over the world.
We know this stuff because we've been there. We've seen it. And we've got the near misses and embarrassing tales to go with it. We'll mix in reporting with our own experiences in the field, and we'll throw in some bad jokes while we're at it.
The Underworld Podcast explores the criminal underworlds that affect all of our lives, whether we know it or not. Available wherever you get your podcasts.
You know, it changed everything. School changed. I remember walking into school, you know, I went back to school. Happened during the middle of the week, so I went back to school Monday or Tuesday of the next week. Everybody's just like looking at me like, whoa, that's the kid, that's the kid, that's the kid. People I didn't know. Yeah, like, that's the kid that was in the car. That's the kid. That kid does. This is the kid doing drugs. This is the kid, blah, blah, blah. It was horrible. I was an athlete and a good kid. Wasn't like on a roll or, you know, anything like, but I did decent in school and I played sports and I just, but after that, it just changed.
It was just all guilt by association.
Yeah. And that, yeah. And my mom told me a story. I asked her about it recently, just because I was going to be on here and talking to you. And she said she remembers being at the mall and buying me shoes. We were in like the shoe store or whatever. And there was parents and kids whispering and pointing at me and stuff. And I don't remember that, but I'm sure it was hard on them as well. And we were well known in the community too. So all the way around, it was bad for the family and bad for me.
What about your teachers? You said you were an athlete, your coaches, did they kind of go along with the, you're just a bad kid like Paul?
Yeah, they, you'd think at a time like that, a coach or something, that would be the kind of a role model that would take you aside and be like, okay, you're with me now. You know, we're going to be in the gym or we're going to do this. But I remember walking into like weights and the weights coach was the weights teacher was the football coach and he didn't even want me in his classroom. I remember going, some football coaches, they coached or they taught classes that I was in. I actually left a class, withdrawal from a class because he wouldn't give me a fair shot. I mean, they would probably deny that and say, oh, no, he's just, but I'm telling you, you know, they did not want me around their teams. They did not want me around their players. Like if players couldn't be seen with me. So like football guys and stuff, like we could hang out outside of school, but we couldn't be walking in the hallway together. They didn't want to see that. They didn't want to see their athletes hanging out with this druggy, alcoholic kid, you know, that they just thought it was trouble. And I'd never been in any trouble before this at all. No trouble at all. Good kid, well-mannered. I was never in any trouble. And just this one instance, it was like, all right, that's it for him. It's crazy to me.
That's amazing. So you got this reputation. And what you wrote when you messaged me once is that you said you played into that role. What does that mean?
Yeah, I think I just... So I was like, okay, well, because, you know, sports was a big outlet for me, just go and blow off steam and stuff. So I didn't have that anymore. And I was still had friends and stuff, but I fell into more like the party scene and picked up smoking cigarettes and hanging out with maybe the not so desirable people. And just kind of, I thought to myself, well, they already think this is what I do, so I might as well do it anyway, you know? You're left in school. I'm just going to, I'll party and hang out and do my own thing. Yeah, I wish I wouldn't have. I wish I would have fought. And, you know, looking back now, that wasn't the right choice, but.
Yeah, that must have been so tough for your parents to see that, because they know you're not really like that.
Yeah.
But now it's like this incident steered you in the wrong direction.
Yeah, it threw me on a path that I never thought I'd be down. I think back, my football team won state championship my senior year, and that's one thing that stands out to me is I didn't get to play on that, you know, because I went down a dark path. I don't know if I started probably to self-medicate a little bit, because I was very, it was hard on my psyche, hard on my, on the brain to process, you know, all that. Yeah, I had some PTSD things going on with it, I found out later on, you know, nightmares and stuff like that. But my parents, I was doing what I was doing, but they were always behind me 100% of the way, my parents and my brother. So I have to thank them for that.
What was the outcome with Paul?
He was convicted for a felony DUI. That was the charge he got. He pleaded out of some littler ones. So he pleaded guilty to felony DUI. From there, he went on to prison. I think he was sentenced to 5 to 10 years in prison. I know he had some possibility of parole and stuff, and we'll talk about that here in a minute, but, and he was 18 at the time that this happened. He was a year older than me. He had just turned 18. He turned 18 on October 28th, and the accident happened on November 1st. So in the eyes of the law, he's an adult.
Right. So 18 years old, and he goes to prison.
Yeah. Yep.
And he's not still in prison now, right? Do you know where he is today?
I'm not quite sure where he is today. We reconciled a couple times after this. So I remember the first time he was about to get out of prison, he started calling, and I'm a forgiving person. So we talked about kind of what, we never really had an in-depth conversation on what happened the day at the school, but I think everybody's deserving of a second chance. So I know he was getting out. I was in college. So me and my little brother actually said, well, you know, why don't you come over to the town that we're in? And, you know, so he came and hung out with us for a while and didn't work well. He's couch surfed and stayed on our couch forever and then kind of faded off again. And then later on, so we're in college, he fades away, comes back again, tried to reconcile with him again once after my first daughter was born. He just could never get it together. I don't know if there's some mental things that happen to him that start with all this, or he just, you know, he burglaries and stuff like that. So didn't need my family around that. So we lost touch, and I haven't talked to him now in probably 10 years.
It's fascinating. You guys could be best friends in high school, and then your lives take a whole, each of you go a different direction.
I always thought this too is like, he kind of got lucky in a, well, you know, lucky in a sense. He didn't have to go back into school and face all the teachers and face all the kids. And also, like, at this time, our family dynamic, you know, extended family, we're all, it's a very close dynamic. So he's not the one sitting at Thanksgiving looking at his mom, who probably, I don't know, you know, if she has some, because we're not close now. Like, it changed the whole family. So I don't know, but I'm sure they had some sort of like animosity towards me or some kind of, I don't want to say hate. I mean, hate's a strong word, but, you know, looking at me like, well, he's sitting here. Why isn't, so there's, yeah, I just, he got to, he didn't have to go, he didn't have to deal with everybody face to face like I did. So I've always kind of, I hold, not now as a grown man, I don't, but I know at the time for years I held that against him because he didn't have to deal with everything that I had to.
But he was in prison. He was yeah, dealing he with was. Other stuff, right?
Yeah, he was. He was. And that, you know, that's, yeah. So it, but it was hard. It was just hard all the way around.
How old are your kids now?
I have a 1-year-old daughter and a 9-year-old daughter.
So your oldest one is 9. Have you told her this story?
I did. I just recently told her since I knew I was going to be telling it. She's a sweetheart, and the sweetest thing she, so I tell her the story, kind of tell her what happened, and she goes, Daddy, how embarrassing. And I'm kind of like, what do you mean, you know, embarrassing? And she goes, well, you had to go back to school and deal with all these people. And she didn't mean it like she was like embarrassed. I don't know. She just, she grasped the reality of it was probably pretty hard for me, you know, to go back and face people. And so I thought that was funny that she told me that.
That's some insight for a 9-year-old.
She has some, I tell you what.
8 years ago, you threw away all the newspaper clippings about that accident. What did it mean to you to do that?
Yeah, it was just like getting rid of, I was hanging on to it. The media didn't do a good job of covering the story, I didn't think. They, at the time, my name and stuff was in the paper. As far as my mom and my dad can remember, they never gave permission for people to print my name. I was underage at the time. I don't know if that's the fact. There was so much going on. Somebody could have called and asked my mom or dad, and maybe they just didn't communicate on that. So I'm not going to, I don't want to put that out there that the newspaper people printed my name when they shouldn't have. I needed to get rid of all that. There was pictures and stuff in there. I showed the car, how crunched the car was. The day after, the front page of the paper was my mom standing with me as they had me up on the stretcher. That was the front page of the paper the next day. for me, it was time to move on. Yeah, time to move on from all that. I had a new life, a little girl to raise, and it was just, I needed to move on from that. I needed to cut that tie, quit hanging on to it. You can't live in the past.
Right. And I can see where doing something like that would be just kind of mentally and physically just closing that chapter of your life and just looking forward.
Yeah. And I had to do that. And I kind of always told myself, well, I wanted to show my kids one day what happened or something, but you know what? I don't really, I told my daughter, my oldest daughter, the story, and I'll tell my youngest one day. But other than that, they don't need to see or the pictures or what was written. You know, I don't think they need to.
One last question. You've said that this accident changed how you look at the world. How's that?
I think it's crazy how fast an adult or a mentor they give up on kids very quick. I think it maybe somebody spent a little more time with me as a young person, I would have had a little better outlook on it. I don't trust very many people. You know, I have a close inner circle and my wife and my mom and dad and brothers and brother and stuff, but I just couldn't believe how fast people are to give up on you. You know, they didn't give me a second chance or anything. No, you would think a coach or something would have grabbed me and been like, hey, like, I know what you're going through, and let me give you a little, you know, let me mentor you a little bit. Let's keep you, you know, keep you focused, keep your mind off of it. There was none of that. There was no, hey, we're here to help. Let me take that back a little bit. I had a counselor in high school that she's the only reason I got through high school. I mean, there was a time there where I was getting ready to fail out. So she did pull me aside, and I was in her office quite a bit talking to her. And I had a couple teachers as well that helped tutor me and stuff and get me through high school. So there were people, but not a lot, and no coaches and stuff. When, you know, I thought that they had my back, and they absolutely did not.
When you think of a coach, you think of pep talk,
right?
You know, like, hey, this wasn't your fault. You can get through this. You know, let's get it through it together.
Yeah.
The counselor that you spoke of that really helped you, are you still in touch with her at all today?
I am not. I've talked to her a couple times as I've gotten older, but I looked her up. I actually looked her up before I was going to do this because I wanted her to maybe hear it. So I kind of keep researching that, but I haven't talked to her in many years now. But she was great.
That's what occurred to me, is that somebody like that, she would love to hear how she's the one. She's
oh, absolutely.
Reason you made it through high school.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll continue to look for her and hopefully be able to give her a call. And when this comes out and stuff, have her listen to it. But she was just a family wise. She helped my family too. And she was amazing through the whole thing.
And what's her first name?
Her first name's Nancy.
Nancy.
Yeah.
Good job, Nancy.
Yeah, she was an angel for sure.
Is there any part of this that we haven't talked about that you want to mention?
I do want to say present day, I'm raising my kids and stuff, and I'm sober. So that's just, you know, telling the story and everything I've gone through, you know, to this point, I live a sober lifestyle now, and I'm proud of that. So it took me a while to get there. I stopped in August of 23, but just wanted to throw that out there, that and you can get through things. Drugs and alcohol don't help anything, you know, they make things worse.
You can see pictures of Jonathan from back in high school as well as his family today in the episode notes at the website whatwasthatlike.com/169. And when you go there, tell me if you see any resemblance between Jonathan and a really well-known celebrity. I asked him, do people ever comment about that? And he said, yep, I get that all the time. So let me know if you see it too. And guess what? Raw Audio 39 was just released. Hard to believe we've done 39 episodes in that series. These are bonus exclusive content for supporters of the podcast. In this episode, a man has too much to drink at a wedding reception, and it does not end well for him.
I have a very irate, drunk dad. He has no shirt on. He's on the outside of the building. He's trying to beat people up. He's yelling.
some spring breakers in Florida decide to try some hard drugs, and they all overdose.
People are passing out.
How many?
Three people passed out.
Three people are passing out?
Yeah, it's because they drank a lot. Like, a lot.
And a Florida man goes into a tiger's enclosure during feeding time.
Where is the male at? Is he still in the enclosure with the tiger?
They are still. No, he's outside of the enclosure. He got out, but the tiger got him.
And yes, all three of those happened in Florida. You can binge all 39 raw audio episodes and get the regular podcast episodes ad-free by signing up to support the show. And you can even try it out for free. On an iPhone, just go to the What Was That Like podcast and click on Try Free. If you use Android, just go to whatwasthatlike.com/plus. You'll be joining the hundreds of other people who support the show, and I appreciate that. Graphics for this episode were created by Bob Bretz. Full episode transcription was created by James Lai. This week's listener story is from an Ethiopian-American woman, Meklit Hedero. She's a singer and a podcast host. Her podcast is called Movement, and it's full of stories about global migration told through music. Now, if you enjoy listening to her storytelling as much as I did, you'll want to check out her podcast. You can find Movement with Meklit Hedero on the podcast app you're using right now, or at her website, meklitmusic.com. That's M-E-K-L-I-T music.com. Her listener story is about being stuck in the Arctic. Stay safe. See you soon.
My name is Meklit Hedero, and I want to tell you about the time that I went from the equator to getting stuck just outside the Arctic Circle within the course of 24 hours. So I was in a music residency in Kampala, Uganda, right around the equator. And it was time to go home after a beautiful few weeks spending time with musicians from all across the Nile Basin. It was part of a project that I co-founded years ago called the Nile Project, and we were just finishing up teaching each other about each other's music, learning music, co-arranging. It was glorious. Got on the plane from Kampala, Uganda to Amsterdam. And I'm on this leg that is going from Amsterdam to Seattle, and then from Seattle to San Francisco, where I live. Just outside Amsterdam, around 45 minutes into the flight, I noticed something sort of funny. The wing, it doesn't look right. I was sitting in a window seat because I always get a window seat. And I was like, what? No, the wing, gosh, that wing looks just like it looks when we're landing. That's interesting. Moments later, the pilot gets on the intercom and is all like, oh, ladies and gentlemen, you know, the way that pilots do. And he tells us that the wing flap is stuck in the up position. And I'm like, okay, well, put it down. Okay, they cannot put it down. And surprise, surprise, this means that we are burning gas at about twice the rate that we are supposed to. And we need to land, except that we are over the Atlantic or about to be over the Atlantic, right? Like, this was the leg of the flight from Amsterdam to Seattle. So I'm like, but where in the world are we going to land? And they're just telling us we are doing our best to find a landing strip. Now, these are not the words you want to hear from your pilot. You know, the murmurs start rolling through the whole plane and you hear the whispers and some kid starts crying like 10 rows back and you feel the parents like trying to hold in their own stress. And me, I'm just like, I am dumbfounded. What is happening? So the flight attendants try to reassure us that it's going to be okay. And you know, I'm like, okay, you probably are reading off a script that says you're supposed to tell everybody that it's going to be okay. But guess what? We are over the Atlantic and we need to find a landing strip or we're going to go down. So obviously, you know, everybody's talking to each other at this point. Like, all social conventions are broken. You're talking to the people in the row in front of you. You're talking to the people in the rows behind you. You're just like, you know, desperately searching for bars on your phone. And it takes some hours at this point, right? It takes some hours before the pilots say, "We found a place to land." The relief is palpable. But where? Where are we supposed to land? Well, the pilots found a landing strip in a place called Esquialit, Canada, which is just outside the Arctic Circle. Yes, remember that I had just been on the equator that morning. It was almost funny, but sort of, you know, twisted, twisted kind of funny. But they did. They found a landing strip, and the landing strip was built in World War II for Allied forces from North America, Canada, and the US to be able to stage flights to England. It is the closest air strip in North America to Europe. Now, it is generally not in use anymore, but it is in good enough shape that we can land there. Okay, hallelujah, we found a place. So we start to descend, and all I can see is white. You know, the clouds are white. The water is reflecting the clouds, and it's shimmering. It's shimmering gray. And we start to see brown. There's lots of rocks, brown rocks and gray rocks, and not a single drop of green. Like, there are no trees. There are no plants. In my mind, I'm thinking to myself, maybe there are lichen somewhere. Maybe there's like green moss somewhere on these rocks. But other than that is billowing snow, billowing white snow, brown and gray rocks. We land, and I am so relieved. The guy sitting next to me worked for a ski apparel company. And he happened to have an extra hat, a ski hat that, much to my sheer delight, actually fit over my afro, which is not normal. Like, mostly if somebody says, "I have a hat for you," it ain't gonna fit me. But this one somehow did. And also to my delight, I had bought a pair of African print oven mitts that I had intended to give as a gift to my housemate at the time. And those were going to be my gloves. Remember, I just came from the very warm equator. So these gloves and this hat totally saved me. We stayed on the tarmac for a good long while, a couple of hours, until they ferried us off eventually and we got into a school bus. Now, I don't know if any of you remember what it's like on a school bus, but these things are totally uninsulated, right? Like, there is no, like, maybe the heater reaches the school bus driver, but it does not reach you all the way in the back. Once again, thank God for those African print oven mitts and the ski hat from my neighbor. It was 50 below zero, and they take us to a giant community center. Now, at the community center, they have got they've got air hockey tables everywhere, and everybody just starts playing air hockey. I mean, at that point, there was only one way to get the tension of the moment out, which was like, when are we going to get out of here? So it's just like, it becomes this competitive air hockey tournament situation. And eventually, a couple of beers make their way into this group of people, and we start kind of drinking, and everybody's talking to each other. Because once again, like, yeah, social conventions are totally out of the window. I notice that someone is looking at me, and I turn around and see this person who's very clearly an Ethiopian guy, you know, and I'm Ethiopian, he's Ethiopian. And so we're like, "Hey," and he's like, "Actually, I know you. I know you're Maklit." And I was so surprised that somebody on this flight would recognize me. I mean, what in the world are the chances? It turns out his name was Lilay Demos. He's this amazing Oscar-nominated producer. He had this film at the time called Difrat, which was making the rounds to all of the film festivals. Is this beautiful, powerful story. And turns out the film was going to be at Lincoln Center some months from then. And I ended up opening for his film at Lincoln Center, you know, what are the chances? Got stuck in the Arctic and got a gig out of it. We were there for about 8 to 10 more hours waiting for a plane to arrive from Atlanta. It finally does. We get back on. We go through security at this tiny, 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 tiny little airport. And, you know, everywhere around, we see these beautiful indigenous syllabary carvings, drawings. And it was just a small peek, the one small peek that we got into what the community was that actually lived in this place called Esqualiat, Canada, because after all, we'd only been at the community center. We got on the flight, made it to Seattle. A few hours after that, I was on my way back home to San Francisco.
Hey, this is Scott. Did you know we offer a premium feed of this show that is completely ad-free and there are bonus episodes? Go to whatwasthatlike.com/plus or just click the link in the show notes of any episode to learn more and to sign up. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts, you can sign up right there in the app by clicking try free at the top of the episode list. And I hope to see you in the premium feed soon.